to The Divine Breadcrumb with your hosts, Carol Campos and Deb Sorensen. Carol and Deb have always believed the universe helps people on their path by sending signs, clues, or what they call divine breadcrumbs. A divine breadcrumb can create both small and massive shifts in a person's life. On this podcast, Carol and Deb will speak with authors, healers, entrepreneurs, and other amazing people across the globe to discuss these pivotal moments. So get ready to learn, to love, and to laugh. And remember, the universe always provides if you allow it to. Enjoy the show.
Hi, it's Carol, co-host of The Divine Breadcrumb. This episode is brought to you by Carol L. Campos Coaching. Why coach with me when there are so many coaches out there? I do things differently. I don't jump right into your goal. Why? Well, what I've learned is that the subconscious mind is running 90% of the show. That's where we start. We clear any emotional blocks and limiting beliefs first, making sure you know your why and are aligned with where you're headed before tackling your goal. Whether you want to change careers or simply want more joy in your life, I can teach you strategies to help you gain the clarity needed to go where your heart is calling. To get started, I invite you to sign up for a free discovery session at carollcampos.com. Together, let's light your path. Hi, everyone. This is Carol.
This is Deb. Welcome back to The Divine Breadcrumb.
So today we welcome back Wendy Taylor, founder of the West Place Animal Sanctuary. We had Wendy on earlier this year to talk about how she transitioned from a managing partner at her law firm to rescuing animals from abuse and neglect cases. So if you haven't listened to that, we invite you to check out episode 14. But today we're going to talk with Wendy about something completely different. On 9/11, Wendy was leaving early from a vacation in Italy. She didn't want to leave, but she was getting pressure from work that she needed to get back to the office. The series of events that happened next, well, let's just say you can't make this up. So pull up a chair as Deb and I talk to Wendy about an experience that caused her to see friendship and selflessness at a whole new level. Wendy, welcome back.
Ladies, thank you both for having me. It's wonderful to be speaking with you again.
This is a very different topic, but it's just such an amazing story, and we're just very humbled that you're willing to share. So first of all, thank you for agreeing to come back on and talk about these personal experiences.
I'll do my best. Hopefully I won't get choked up like I heard myself get on the last podcast.
That's okay. We take that as a good sign, actually. If you would, set the stage for us, starting with getting the call to return to the States. What was your mindset at the time?
Well, I was on vacation with some friends, actually a good friend of mine named David. It was a work event, and it happened to be in Italy, and I was lucky enough to be able to get to go with him. So we had a great week and not a care in the world like most people do when they're on vacation, just having fun and relaxing. But of course, I was the managing partner of a litigation medical malpractice law firm. And I guess you could say it was a bit of a high stress level job. So we were always moving. And I think more than a week away was a little too much for my firm to handle going without me. So I did get the pressure to come home. So I decided to leave my friends on their last leg of the trip. They were headed somewhere else. And instead of me going with them, I decided I was flying back to the States, of course, by myself. Thinking nothing of it other than since I was flying into JFK, I have another very good friend who lives in New York City and works on Wall Street. And right near the towers, his name is Steven. And I took the opportunity to say, hey, why don't I meet you for lunch in the city when I land before I head back to Rhode Island? So that was how I started that late night / early morning, thinking nothing was going to happen.
Mm. So tell us, how did that fateful day unfold for you?
So we were on the plane, and this was, of course, back in the day when not that many people had cell phones. Mm-hmm. 2001 was, you know, definitely the early part. I remember when I was in law school, I had one of those bag phones that you could hook into your car. Right. But after that, I didn't possess a cell phone, even as a lawyer. I just, at the moment, I didn't find that it was necessary. So we were on the plane and there was a movie playing. I was half paying attention, half not, just getting ready to land. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden the plane drops significantly. You could feel it very quickly. It wasn't right. It wasn't just turbulence. It wasn't a bump. They weren't avoiding birds. You could feel that we dropped thousands and thousands of feet, you know, instantly. And everyone just looks around. No one really knows what to make of it. The plane felt like it was okay. But then you could hear us bank to the right noticeably, very, very quickly. Again, anyone who's flown more than one time, you get in the groove of this is normal, this is not normal. And it wasn't normal, but it still wasn't so out of the ordinary anyone was panicking. And then the captain comes on and just says very professionally that for FAA reasons, we were not landing in New York and we were being diverted. And then we start to wonder, was it the plane? What, you know, was it anything? He couldn't tell us anything. He wouldn't tell us anything and just said he was busy in the cockpit, but he promised to come back and give us a full explanation once we were on the ground. Well, even the term full explanation, you could see everyone's brains turning. And again, the plane itself, the cabin was silent. No one, you know, other than whispering, I wonder what this is. I wonder what this is. But we still didn't think too much of it. Mm. And for some reason, we had to put all of our window shades down. They didn't want us knowing what was going on. And somebody across the aisle from me opens his to peek out. And now all I can see is water. There's no land. And we can tell we're starting to descend and we're coming in for a landing, but there's still no land. And that didn't make any, there was just water everywhere. So we actually do touch down. And instead of everyone being, you know, very grateful, and sometimes the audience, the passengers will clap, you know, for a yeah. good landing. No one does that because we're not really sure what's happening. So the captain does come back on. And that's when everything gets real. And he tells us that he promised us an explanation and that although he knew we were anxious for good news, he didn't have any to give us. And he pauses and he tells us what he's about to say is very difficult. And you can actually hear him getting a little choked up. And at that point, everyone starts to think, what is happening? And he asks us all to remain calm. And he then just says the worst thing you could possibly imagine. And he says the United States has been attacked. And he says it with, I can't even describe, it wasn't forceful. It wasn't passionate. It was, but it was full of feeling. And it was full of sadness. You could hear it in his voice and you could tell that he was barely getting through it. And, you know, that's when there's just this silence that rolls over the cabin. And then you can just hear everybody starting to break down and everybody starting to sob and cry. And it was one of those situations where it's unreal. And you look around and you think, what does that mean? Oh, my God. And, you know, I'm traveling alone. So I'm looking around to look at the reaction of everyone else. I don't know what to feel. They don't know what to feel. I've never felt more alone. And then he proceeds to tell us what he knew at the time. And you have to remember, as I'm sure you all do, that at the time when the World Trade Center towers were hit and the Pentagon was hit, a lot of people still thought it was either just a small aircraft that made a mistake. And then even when the second one got hit, people still didn't necessarily make a connection immediately. And so by the time he told us, he had been told that it was probably the work of suicide bombers and terrorists. And still, that's all he knew, because that's all the world knew at the moment. So of course, my immediate thought goes to my friend Steven, because he worked there. And I thought, oh my God, I don't even know if he's alive. And my heart just sinks. And, you know, I'm not thinking about me because I'm fine. I'm not thinking about my family because I know they're fine. Never realizing that they knew I was flying into JFK and they didn't know if I was fine. They didn't know if I was alive because they didn't know if I was on one of those planes. So I don't want to say being in the middle of it, because by no means was I in the middle of anything. But being in the middle of what was happening on our plane in that vacuum was certainly the beginning of an experience.
Yeah. They kept you on the plane for quite a while, right?
They kept us on the plane for over a day.
Wow.
I think we were on the plane for about 27 hours. And granted, that's also the flight time. But from the time I stepped foot on that plane, we didn't get back off of the plane for about 27 hours or so.
Wow.
And it was interesting because obviously we ran out of food and drink. And then the things you don't think about, people who smoked, there was nowhere for them to go. They weren't allowed to smoke. You couldn't step off the plane. You didn't think about how many people needed to use the restroom facilities and how long those facilities were going to hold up under that many people needing them for that long a period of time. And I will tell you, it was the most organized chaos you can possibly imagine. And everyone was so respectful of everyone else. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. So once you were let off the plane, could you tell us a little bit about what happened next? What happened over the next few days?
So when we finally get word that we were allowed to leave the plane, and I think it was at some ridiculous hour, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, we were also told you can't bring anything but what you're wearing. Nothing. No clothes. Don't even go into your suitcase. Don't open the overhead bins. What you've got on is what you've got on. And we leave, and of course, as you would probably expect, the military's there, you know, weapons in hand. We get shuttled off to customs, and then a bus, which takes us to a hockey stadium, where we're again processed, then another bus to a shelter. And I think by then it was 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. And we end up the shelter that my particular group, I didn't know anyone at the time, but my particular group of people, we were told to go into the gymnasium, for lack of a better term, in the back of a church. And there were hundreds of Red Cross blankets and pillows just laid out across the gymnasium floor. And that's where, you know, we knew we were going to be spending an indefinite period of time.
Wow. Yeah, it's really intense. And I was thinking, you know, when something really traumatic happens, like, you know, 9/11, I think everybody, whether, you know, in a situation like yours, or even for us, just, you know, people who were just getting ready for work, who, you know, were safe, everyone remembers what they were doing when they got the news. That stands out so clearly to so many people. The rest of it is kind of a fog. So I was wondering, for you, what are some of the memories that really stand out from that day?
From that day, from that week, there are so many. But even just from that first 24-hour period when we were finally off the plane, there were, because we were living it. We had nothing to do. We could do nothing but try to gather information. And that's all we wanted. None of us slept. We were asking for televisions, for news. And, you know, the news was the Canadian news, which of course wasn't as much as we wanted it to be, but it was all we had. And frankly, it was probably all we could handle at the time. So it was probably a blessing in disguise. And we've stayed glued to the television. We watched every clip we could get our eyes on over and over and over again. And you have to remember, not everyone had cell phones. Almost no one had cell phones. On the entire plane, out of several hundred people, six people had cell phones. And I'm not even sure any of them really brought them with them, because they ran out of battery while they were on the plane. And since you couldn't go and get your charger or your plug, they were just paperweights at that point. So we had no access to anyone other than our group of passengers. And there was a landline, and it was in the rectory, and it was in the office. And we were told that we could all make one phone call to whoever we needed to try to reach out to. But picture hundreds of people needing to use one telephone landline. And the line waiting for that phone stretched all the way down the hallway and right back into the gymnasium again. And people stood in line, not just for hours, but you know, for a day. We just stand in line and wait to see if they could get a call to somebody to make sure that they were finding that someone they cared about was alive, and letting someone who cares about them know that they were alive.
Mm. Wow. I can't even imagine. I just can't even imagine in that. And it's even too big.
It was big. And clearly September 11th was much, much, much bigger than our little group of passengers. But what we went through at the time was all we could take.
Right.
So we actually haven't said where it was you had landed. So can you just fill everyone in where exactly you had landed and you were staying at this point?
Yes, I was one of the fortunate ones. I landed in a little town called St. John's, Newfoundland, at the time, Canada. And it's a small, sleepy town. It was formerly its own country until it joined Canada in the mid-1900s. And it is not a busy place. And they informed us that they had never seen more than about three or four international flights in a week's time. Yeah. And in the span of a few hours, there were 27 wide-bodied international jets lined up wing to wing on the tarmac, the grass, the street next to it.
Wow.
Never seen anything like it. Those jets brought 4,700 stranded passengers to St. John's.
Wow.
The town didn't have the fuel, the mechanics, the customs agents, anything it needed. It just didn't. It wasn't equipped. It was never meant to have to handle that.
Right.
And fortunately, what St. John's did have was a lot of really, really caring people that were willing to drop everything in their lives to volunteer their time 24 hours a day for as long as we were going to be there.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
It's just so amazing. I think that day brought out so much good in people. You know, so many of us have talked about it that, you know, we're in the States at the time, just the kindness people would show each other at the store, at the gas station, the smiles, kind of the trying to comfort one another, perfect strangers.
Absolutely. And I wish in our country that's still perpetuated.
Exactly. And that's what I was thinking about. It's just, it's so sad because it's in all of us to have all that compassion and empathy and caring, and where did it go? And I think what really hit me at the time, and I think for a lot of people, is watching the footage all over the world and people in other countries crying and just sending us love and caring. That was just so impactful.
It was. It truly was. And especially with the Newfoundlanders, they have that inside of them. It was easy for it to come out because I don't think they ever dampen that sense of community, that sense of volunteerism, and that just sense of belonging and making sure everyone feels like they belong, because they did it so flawlessly that's got to be just the way they practice their life.
Oh, that's great. Well, and also I wanted to ask you, from the times we've talked, I mean, you're truly a person who kind of takes the bull by the horns and such a helper person. And I think we had talked about the quote from Mr. Rogers that, you know, when bad things happen, you know, look to the helpers. And you seem like you would be a helper. Were you kind of, you know, on autopilot at that time? Were you trying to help others?
No, the exact opposite. And I was kind of a wreck. I was helpless. I wasn't helpful. I wasn't the person I am now or the person I was before that. I just fell apart. I sat outside of the church in the grass, just trying to make sense of everything. You know, they were all pitching in, and they honestly didn't want any of us to do anything. I think they realized we were all overwhelmed, but yeah. I still would like to think that I'm the person on the inside that says, I'm okay. Let me pitch in and help. And I didn't, I couldn't. I just sat there with everyone else looking around and, you know, feeling sorry for ourselves, feeling sad for our country, worried about everything. And fortunately, a neighbor that lived right across the street from the church came over, and she brought her dog, and her name was Sarah, and her dog's name was Hope, of all things. Her dog's name was Hope. It was just meant to be. And she came over to say hello and see what was going on and offer her support as well. And of course, it's the first animal we see, and who doesn't love a dog? And I'm an animal person too. So Hope makes her way right over to me. You know, I pet her, she's kissing me and licking me, and she immediately makes me feel a little bit closer to home, a little bit more connected. And Sarah makes her way over to me and introduces herself. And long story short, here we are, almost 20 years later, and we developed a friendship on that day that's lasted for almost 2 decades.
Oh, wow. I love it.
That's incredible. But that's a bond that you just, bonds forged under those circumstances really do just last.
Absolutely. The gentleman that was sitting on the plane across the aisle from me that peeked his window open, he was the first one to talk to me and ask me if I was okay. His name is Danny. And same thing. Danny and I are still friends, and we always will be. He lives in Philadelphia. Sarah lives in St. John's. But there's not a holiday or a birthday, and certainly not a September 11th that goes by where we all don't reach out and sometimes just have a personal one-on-one conversation and sometimes a three-way conversation.
That's great.
You go through something like that with someone, and I don't think that's a bond that will ever stop.
I agree. So you returned to St. John's years later. What was that like?
Oh, yeah. So we got back after about 7 or 8 days in St. John's. We were finally given permission to leave and come home. And I go back to life. And I'm practicing one day, and my secretary pages me and says, why am I not surprised, but there's a television production company on the phone for you. and I did a little bit of, I was a theater minor in college. So every once in a while, I'll do a little bit of acting, just background work, you know, not really any speaking roles, nothing big. But so when a production company or an agent or something does call, it wasn't a big deal because, you know, maybe they just needed me in the background for something. So I answer the phone, not thinking anything of it. But Alliance Atlantis, a production company from Toronto, decided they were going to film a documentary about all of the relationships that were forged between the Canadian volunteers and the stranded travelers. And because I had come back, and you know, different people find different ways to come to terms with something they've been through or something that happened. And for reasons I can't really explain to you, I decided to write an article, a newspaper article about it. And I really just submitted it as a letter to the editor kind of thing. And little did I know it was going to make the front page above the fold of the newspaper.
Wow.
And that ended up getting a lot of press. It got put online and people all over the world not only saw it, but they commented on it. And I guess somehow it made its way to this production company. And they found my article and either news clips or articles that maybe other passengers across, American passengers across Canada had written or had been interviewed about. And they reached out to maybe four or five of us and thought all of our stories were very uplifting and enlightening and positive messages to get across to the rest of Americans. And they wanted to film a documentary and they wanted it to be aired on the 1 year anniversary. So the following September 11th, they wanted to have this about, you know, the silver clouds that you can, sorry, the silver linings that you can find, you know, in this horrible, horrible cloud. Mm. And I had sworn I would never step on a plane. I would never fly again. Mm. And of course, they asked me to do it a few months later. Wow. And I thought, I really don't want to. Yeah. And I hadn't flown since, but again, it was something that was bigger than me. Right. And it was something I felt, this is my way that I can pitch in and I can give back and I can finally help. And by getting this message of positivity and bonding and camaraderie between countries, I can get that across. It was the least I could do. So I wholeheartedly agreed to participate in the documentary.
Great.
That's great. And yeah, what a great opportunity. How were you received when you got back to St. John's?
I probably should have expected the welcome that I got. But of course, to me, this was a blip in their lives. This was a small portion of their life. And when it was over, they got back to doing what they do and being who they are. And I was one of almost 100 people that were at this particular church, you know, sleeping on the blankets. I didn't think they knew my name. I didn't think they remembered me. And because we weren't allowed to bring anything off the plane, of course, we didn't have any clothes for the week. So the Red Cross also had brought in clothes. Now, I know you can't see me on a podcast, but I am 5'1". I barely weigh 100 pounds. I'm a size 0 petite. And there aren't a lot of clothes out there that are going to fit somebody as tiny as me. So my choices were very limited. And the only thing I could find was this pair of pajamas, top and bottom. And they were flannel printed teddy bears, like happy teddy bears everywhere. And I thought, this is great. This is what I'm wearing. And, you know, everybody doesn't need to see me in better clothes. I'm just going to walk around in this. So I did. I was pretty much in those clothes most of the week. So, of course, when we leave, and we all want to put it behind us. And I think, you know, maybe a little too excitedly, I take the teddy bear pajamas and toss them back into the Red Cross clothing box on my way out the door. Like, you know, I don't need these anymore. And so when I fly back, and of course they want to reintroduce Sarah and I in person, they want to interview both of us together, but they also want me to go back to the church. There's going to be a mass there and they want me to attend the mass and they want to film it. So I just figure, okay, low key, no big deal. I walk through the door. Not only are all the volunteers lined up inside the entranceway, but they're all yelling my name and smiling and waving like, who's going to hug me first? And one of the volunteers walks over and hands me my teddy bear pajamas back.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
They reached into the box after they saw me toss them. And somehow, some way, they knew they were going to need to give those back to me one day.
Wow.
That's amazing.
It was the funniest thing.
Oh, I love that. I can just picture you, you know, just knowing how busy you are and running around in your little teddy bear pajamas. My gosh, it's just such a actually happy image despite what was going on. And I love how that kind of came full circle when you went back.
Yes, it made for a very nice ending to a lifelong group of friendships, you know, that were forged based on that day. And when I say that the Newfoundlanders have all of that beauty inside them, right there, that just proves it. They didn't think they were ever going to see me again. You know, what made them grab those? It was as if they just knew that our paths were not just going to cross by, you know, Facebook messaging and phone calls, but that our paths were going to cross in person again.
Yeah, you're just forever connected.
Absolutely. Always will be.
Yeah. So, you know, we're winding down on time, but I wanted to ask, you know, where does your mind go every September 11th now? You know, what do you think was the most positive lesson that came out of your experience?
Well, on every September 11th, and it's taken me a very long time to not shut down on every September 11th. And I mean, really, literally just shut down and, you know, spend the morning crying, take the day off from work and just not be able to function because I think of my connection to that day. And, you know, here we are, thank goodness, here we are so far away from it that I at least don't do that anymore. And I will always have respect for the day. And I always do. And I always know it's coming. It's kind of like the clock is ticking down because I know my heart will be in knots that day. But knowing that I know that I will talk to Sarah, talk to Danny, talk to Steven, talk to David, all of my friends, my old friends and my new friends from that day, knowing that I will get the chance to connect with them and that day is always so important. And especially with Sarah, she was a woman that was a stranger. And within a few days of meeting me, she walks over to me one morning over a cup of coffee and hands me a little piece of paper. And on the piece of paper was a poem that she wrote about me.
Wow.
And it was the most moving thing. And she understood exactly what I was going through that day. And she was able to put words on paper that expressed how I was feeling better than I could put words on paper that expressed how I was feeling.
Wow. Wow.
And every September 11th, I always reread that to myself.
Mm. Very special gift.
Yeah, for sure.
So do you think you'll ever go back to St. John again?
She and I always talk about it. She had actually never been to the United States. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, one of her sons had a baby and they decided to go to Disney World. Well, of course, Disney World couldn't be further away in the country than Rhode Island. But so I didn't get to see her, but she finally got to the United States and she loved it. And we always do talk about trying to get together. Yeah. Which, as you can see, is hard. It's not like trying to get together with a friend who lives one town over and you can't find the time. Imagine someone who lives in another country and
right.
can't find the time. But I don't think that distance really makes any difference.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that connection's there no matter what.
Absolutely. You know, we'll never forget that day and we'll never forget each other.
Absolutely. Wow. Such an intense story.
It is, but it's such a beautiful story too. I mean, it just, I love that the people of St. John's were just so welcoming and, you know, what was such a traumatic experience could have been worse if it was, you know, a situation where you felt like you were intruding. And I think that the world just kind of opened its arms and it's just a lovely story.
It really was. It always will be. I don't even think that I did it justice today. If anyone can get their hands on that documentary that I believe it had two different names, but I believe I can't remember if it was in the United States or in Canada, that it was called A Diary Among Friends. I think that was the United States name for it. And then in Canada, I think they called it Stranded Yanks. with their sense of humor, Stranded Yanks, A Diary Among Friends. And that will not only tell the story of all of the wonderful volunteers from Newfoundland, but so many Canadians across their country and how they all came out in, you know, thousands, thousands and thousands and thousands, because they had to take care of 30,000 of us.
Wow.
And that's a lot of people. And it took a lot of people. And that documentary really tells just an incredibly beautiful tale of friendship and camaraderie.
Mm. Definitely have to look for that.
Yeah, as you were talking, I was just looking on IMDb. Yeah, Stranded Yanks, A Diary Between Friends, TV movie, 2002.
Yes, and there's a wonderful coffee table book that was a companion to it as well, you know, with all the stories written down, all the photos written down. And so they really did do a very good job honoring all that work and all that volunteerism. I think they should be really proud of that documentary that they put together.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so hopefully people can find that. Well, Wendy, again, thank you so much for sharing your very personal story with Deb and myself, our audience. We're truly humbled because I know this is something you kind of keep close to your heart.
Yes. Thank you for letting me share it. Thank you for putting up with my crackle in my voice, which I know I will hear when this plays back. and letting me persevere through talking about this.
I think the crackle in the voice is true of all three of us with this episode.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks again, everybody. Thanks for listening. As always, you can find us on our website, thedivinebreadcrumb.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, subscribe, post a review for us, send us questions, comments. We love hearing from all of you. Thanks again for listening. And Wendy, thank you again so much. I think you are through with tragedies for this lifetime.
That would be fair to say. I don't know who I can make that deal with, but yeah, I'm done.
Thanks again for sharing with us. We love chatting with you.
Thank you so much for having me, ladies. Always wonderful.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.